Welcome to Worst Year Ever, a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
Welcome to the worst year ever, except for everything's better now and everybody's happy and we solved all of our problems. And that's the end of the whole series.
My mom incorrectly called our show best year ever when I was on the phone with her yesterday, and I started laughing and she didn't realize what she said. And then I said, think about
she's
that.
She's right.
That's what we did. We fixed it. So fixed that's what it year. Is now.
We yeah, I it. Mean, if everything's the absolute worst and then we fix it, then it's no longer the worst. It's the best.
It's the best year ever. All right, everyone, we're done.
Thanks, okay. Mom.
Go home. Well, you're already home. Because
yeah,
of the
I got to stay there because of the, you, yeah.
You can't leave. You can't really do anything else.
Here, we might as well talk for an hour.
And some of you are probably on the verge of homelessness now due to the economic collapse. Should Jesus we talk about Christ. Joe Biden?
Let's talk about the election at the very least.
Okay.
I didn't prep anything about Joe Biden.
I feel like it's been forever since we've talked about politics.
Yeah.
Because it has politics been has been hard to care about.
It is. It's so weird. I mean, well, you were taking a much needed break last week and we chatted with Dave Kim from California's 34th district, and that was a taste of it. But, you know, there's something hopeful in the Dave Kim conversation. Whereas, you know, everything about the 2020 election in general feels very bleak. But it's time. It's important. It's what we originally set
it's what
out
this show
to
is
do.
Going to be, right? And as much as it seems like the current president is really a disaster that everybody hates, and that his opponent is, hiding and coasting and doing well.
Hiding Biden. Why didn't he try that?
I don't know if it's something that he wants Biden. To announce that he's doing. That's definitely like the plan, but I don't think it's good to say. By the way, I'm keeping a low profile.
Yeah. He's biding his time. Still stuck on that one.
I love that.
When we were brainstorming what to talk about, we considered doing an episode that's deep dives in all the vice presidential candidates, but we weren't sure when that information was going to come out, when he was going to pick, if it would make this, outdated immediately. Instead, we've broken it up into a few different components. Robert, you wanted to talk about conventions.
I love conventions.
I would love to learn about what you learned about conventions.
When this all started, this podcast, and also politics, the thing I was most excited about, Katie and Cody, the thing that I had dreams about, that I would wake up at nights in a cold sweat, overcome with glee, over, was taking y'all to the RNC and the DNC.
I know.
Because if you've never been to a political convention, they're terrible. They're just the worst things people do is political conventions. There's something so much less depressing about watching war crimes committed in real time than attending a political convention. Because at least the war crimes involve a degree of physical risk on behalf of the people committing crimes against humanity. Whereas political conventions are crimes against humanity that people get paid $850 an hour to commit. And they're just terrible. And we were going to go, we were going to watch the protests, and we were going to drink terrible mixed drinks with names that were puns based on members of the Republican Party. And we were going to have just a really bad time. We were going to watch Ted Cruz give a speech in person. I don't know if you've ever seen Ted Cruz give a speech in person, but you can see the nictitating membrane on his eyeballs, and the way that the fake skin that he has stretches over the carapace underneath it.
God, I would love to see that in person someday.
The non-Euclidean angles of the geometry of his thorax. Oh my God, it was going to be
small
such
collections of bacteria just like dripping out of his mouth every once in a while.
The way he lays his eggs in Chris Christie's nose. All of the things you get at a political convention.
I can't believe I'm saying this, but I was looking forward to that.
It was going to be great.
The last time I saw you guys in person, Robert was in town for a Live Behind the Bastards show, Billy Wayne Davis.
Remember
Live
Shows?
Which was the primary vector by which the coronavirus spread in Los Angeles.
Absolutely.
I remember. I have nightmares about all of your dirty hands that I shook that night. But I love you very much.
I sprayed each and one of your hands with hand sanitizer after every single
night. Homemade hand sanitizer there.
But I also had my lavender one. Do you remember? It was so loving.
You were on the ball.
Yeah.
Kept us all
very
safe.
Relevant. It is relevant. I remember when you were in town, though, Robert. Even at that point, we had the president's speech on at the office, and you were still talking about, ooh, I think it'll be even more fun to go with coronavirus and see what they're doing at these conventions.
It would have been amazing. Oh, and we would have been.
Well, you want to drop like the horror show into the middle of a plague, right? Like that's how you heighten it even more.
It would have been incredible, and we would have been drunk just the whole time, just outrageously wasted, watching a bunch of Republicans lick each other's eyeballs and refuse to wear masks and cough in the middle of crowded elevators. And it would have been wonderful, and at least one of us would have died of lung failure. But unfortunately, that's not going to happen. That future was stolen from us because the president has announced that they're not really going to have a convention anymore.
Is official now, right?
Yeah, this is official. This is official. And it was quite a process of getting him to be like, all right, I guess I won't have thousands of people, most of whom are over age 60, crowd into an auditorium in the middle of a pandemic in Florida, which is famously known as the no hospital beds state. And I feel bummed about that. So what happened, and this is fun, the whole story is very fun. Like 2 months ago, the Democratic Party announced that, you know, because of the pandemic that was killing tens of thousands of people, they were not going to be doing an in-person convention.
Correction. Hundreds of thousands of people. Continue.
Oh, yeah, but just only 150,000 Americans, and I don't care about other people, Katie.
Sure. Okay, fair.
Yeah.
150 confirmed. Okay.
Yeah, 150,000 human beings and then however many foreigners. So now, the Democrats were going to go do the DNC in Milwaukee. And that was going to be terrible. But now it's not really going to happen. So they cut back on everything. And basically, like, you have to kind of legally, just because of the way that, like, political parties operate as legal entities, you have to have some sort of convention, but the Democrats basically said, we're cutting back to just the minimum number of people necessary to, like, you know, there's a bunch of, like, shit that has to happen, right? Like, there's, like, people have to be, like, formal nominations have to be made. There have to be, like, the kind of formal votes that all of the shit that's happened in the primaries up to this point was kind of preparing everyone for. And you have to, like, make, you know, the candidate's got to give a speech, all that sort of stuff. So
yeah, the platform, all that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So they're basically just doing the formal stuff that they legally have to do with the minimum number of people necessary in a massive hotel that's being completely, like very carefully curated and managed to ensure minimum risk of the spread of the virus. Which seems broadly responsible, right? And it'll be useful in terms of, number one, they're kind of risking the minimal number of people. And number two, it will kind of give us an idea of, like, can you do anything in person in the coronavirus era like this without it being a horrendous risk to human life? Like, is it possible to even handle minimal stuff?
Right.
Have you seen numbers of what that actually would look like?
I think, like, it's only like a couple of hundred people. Between, like,
still
the
a
actu-
lot.
Yeah, still between the actual, and not all of those are, like, the people who actually need to be in the room at the same time, right? I think it's like 150 something people who are going to have to like be in a very large auditorium at any given time. Most of what's going to be done is going to be curated content from like different satellite locations that will be streaming over the internet. So it's basically the Democratic convention is going to be one enormous Zoom call. And if you've been on any Zoom calls or if you've heard a friend talk about Zoom calls offhandedly, you know that's going to be terrible. Like the Democratic convention is going to be deeply unpleasant. All of the speeches are going to feel completely soulless and devoid of human connection because that's how it feels whenever politicians who are trained to work rooms have to give speeches over the computer.
I can't wait to see some like terrible jokes that do not land because nobody's even there to like pity laugh.
Oh god, it's gonna be amazing.
They gotta do like canned stuff, right? Like a laugh track or applause track.
Yeah,
like Bill Maher's doing on his show.
If we're lucky, we'll get some really good frozen frames of people where it's buffering and Biden's making some grotesque face. That'll be fun.
Excited for Joe Biden, someone talking to him off camera in the middle of a speech and him asking them what repeatedly while just silence screams at all of us from the empty room around him. That's going to be the part I like.
It'll be fun.
We'll all feel safe and good about the progress we're making and the place we're at.
It won't feel like the country is literally dying and we're all living through the opening scenes of a horror movie. What I love about the Democratic convention is that it won't make a perfect 15 seconds to cut in the middle of all of the rioting and the initial news stories about the spread of the pandemic that looks exactly like the opening to the second Planet of the Apes movie after civilization has been destroyed. And I do think that like the opening of the second Planet of the Apes movie, the Democratic convention is going to end with a single broadcasting tower in Brazil sending out the last message of the human race into the cold, uncaring stars, empty of all intelligent life.
So that's something to look forward to.
It'll culminate in an underground bunker with a nuke, too, right?
Yeah, and we'll be worshiping the nuke. That's going to be the good part. That's when things get better. Yeah,
excellent,
when we paint
excellent.
A nuclear missile gold and worship it. I'm very much looking forward to that, Cody.
Hashtag it gets better.
It does get better if we're talking about the original Planet of the Apes series and not the remake, because they did not have a whimsical nuclear cult who live underground.
Yeah, very disappointing.
Because we don't know how to make movies anymore.
No, we don't. We failed.
But we digress.
Yeah, we do. So that's what the Democrats did, right? Is look at the real world and go, all right, well, the only thing we can think to do is something not creative and deeply disappointing, but at least we won't endanger huge numbers of human lives by doing it.
More
and the Republicans
people
said, fuck that. if there's one thing we love, it's endangering huge numbers of human lives. You fucking cowards.
Yeah, bring it on.
Yeah, so that's what they've been doing. And it was initially supposed to be in Charlotte, North Carolina. And this was kind of like a weird call because Charlotte, the mayor of Charlotte is a Democrat. It's a Democratic city. And North Carolina was a swing state in 2016. It did go for Trump. But it's pretty damn close. And Charlotte, as of this point, is like a pretty solidly Democratic city. So it was kind of like a weird move for President Trump to be like, I'm going to do my convention in Charlotte. And you can see like there's a level of kind of like tactical thinking to it, right? Where, you know, North Carolina is going to be one of the states that Trump is worried about. So holding the convention there, you hope you get a big bump from it. And it kind of like helps you deal with one of the problem areas in your electoral map. So in a normal election, I think Charlotte kind of makes sense as a target.
Yeah.
But when the pandemic hit, it started to become a problem for the president because the mayor of Charlotte, again, like it's one of those things where like there was a lot of debate within like the city council of Charlotte and the local government because they all hate Trump. But also they are desperate for money, especially since the pandemic started to hit. They got even more desperate for money. Mm-hmm. And the convention was going to mean like $200 million in revenue. And the city couldn't really afford to turn that down. Ada Fisher, a national committee woman for the state GOP in North Carolina, told the New York Times, quote, "There are a lot of liberal establishment people here who just don't like the Republican Party. People didn't want it to happen just because Republicans were involved, but Charlotte can't stand to lose $200 million in revenue right now." And that was sort of the that was sort of like why it happened, or why it was on its way to happening. And then as the coronavirus got worse and worse and worse, the mayor started being like, "We're going to have to like actually lock this shit down." And so they, you know, tried to work with the president and kind of said like, "Hey, you can still do the convention here, but we're going to have to socially distance. So we'll have to like basically have half as many people as normal in the arena, and everyone's going to have to wear masks." And that made President Trump furious. The thing that he particularly hated was the idea that he would be giving his speech in front of a half-empty arena, because he wanted to do it into a massive packed crowd of excited fans, and he didn't want them to have masks on because that doesn't look as exciting. And again, all that has ever mattered to him is looking good. So his concern was that, it might not look like a full house.
He's TV man. He knows what he's doing. He's TV man. He knows what he's doing.
Yeah. So, I'm going to read from a quote from a New York Times coverage on kind of the conflicts between Cooper, the mayor of Charlotte, and President Trump. Quote, "On a phone call with Mr. Cooper on May 29th, Mr. Trump said he would not deliver a speech in front of a half-empty arena, and he wanted a quick answer on whether the state would accommodate him, according to two people familiar with the call. Mr. Trump asked Mr. Cooper what he should do. The governor said, or sorry, governor, not mayor. The governor said that they should work to find a way to scale the convention back, one of the people said. As the call wrapped up, the president reminded Mr. Cooper of the ways in which the federal government had come to North Carolina's assistance during the peak of the coronavirus outbreak. I think we've done a good job, Mr. Trump said, testing ventilators. We got you a lot, and that's okay. We've been good to you, Mr. Trump added, according to one of the people familiar with the call, who spoke anonymously to discuss private negotiations. We gave you the National Guard. We gave you a lot, he said to Mr. Cooper. You and I get along good. You've been nice to us about it." Which I love the constant, like, the fact that he can't not be a mafia guy, right?
It's so frustrating.
We offered you our protection.
Like, this governor's being very reasonable and is just being like, "I want to endanger the minimum number of people in your convention." And the president's like, "I sent the National Guard in when you guys were having a disaster over this pandemic. Why won't you let me endanger more people? I got you ventilators. Come on."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah,
like I got did you the enough thing ventilators.
That,
why
I thought
did
I sent, that everyone, I thought I sent you the message.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did the thing that everyone expects him to do. Like the thing he should be doing. Not the National Guard, the ventilators.
Yeah, I'm sorry for referring to Roy Cooper as the mayor. He's the governor. I'm cracked out as hell still working on it. Mm-hmm. My notes are a little chaotic. But yeah, so that's the gist of what happened in Charlotte, right? Is you know, he had a conflict with his governor, and kind of halfway through it, about a month or so ago, as it became clear that that Charlotte wasn't going to kind of back down, or that North Carolina wasn't going to back down on basic health measures, Trump began threatening to move the convention. And his number one pick was Jacksonville, Florida. There were a couple of reasons for this. One of them is obviously Florida is also a swing state right now, right? Like, it's very competitive between Biden and Trump there at the moment. Another reason is that Jacksonville was a pretty reasonable drive from Charlotte. It's not hard to get from one to the other. And another reason is that the president, you know, is a monster who loves endangering people. And if there's anything Florida likes, it's also endangering large numbers of people. And
DeSantis even today was like, hug people. He was recommending people go out and hug to make themselves feel better. So.
And if you're a fan of Governor DeSantis of Florida, I recommend that you hug your family members who are also fans of Governor DeSantis of Florida. We might as well go for it now.
I guess, especially if you have coronavirus.
Yes,
you're
please.
The ones that,
why not? Fuck it.
Go comfort yourself. With your like-minded friends.
Yeah, if you're feeling sick, go comfort yourself by
get your tongue in
ones.
Their ears.
Like, don't suffer alone.
Don't suffer alone.
As my son would say, lick their eyeballs.
Yeah. You know, the best way to register each other to vote is to lick each other's eyeballs. I've often said that.
That's the process. That's what it says in the Constitution.
That is, the Constitution is mostly about how to spread plagues to each other in order to celebrate
the best
freedom.
Methods of eyeball licking. It's very,
and everything
very informative.
In the Constitution is spot on. Go ahead, yep. Robert.
So this was kind of a financial disaster for the Republican Party. Number one, most of the money, they'd already spent all of the money that they'd raised to do the convention in Charlotte, and they couldn't really get it back, right? And they also were out additional money because the government of Charlotte spent a bunch of money to prep for the convention, and the federal government owed them it back, right? Like, because it was kind of fucking Charlotte over, Charlotte had to be compensated for the money that they'd spent prepping. And all of the money that the Republican Party had put into things like, you know, booking hotels and security, most of that was non-refundable. So all of these donations, you know, every year, or not every year, but every time that there's a big election convention, the parties solicit huge numbers of donations from their richest members. And there's like a bunch of benefits that you get, obviously, as a politico from throwing money into something like a convention, including access to the candidate. But all of these, you know... A number of these people threw money into Charlotte because, you know, planning for that and fundraising for that started ahead of the coronavirus epidemic. And then the epidemic hit and that money was blown and they were trying to raise money for Jacksonville. And all of these rich people who were Republican Party backers were not willing to throw more money in part because they didn't want to risk their own lives going to a convention. So it became increasingly clear over like the course of June that this was not going to be, no matter what Trump said, a real convention, that nobody except for the most dangerously unhinged people wanted to show up at all, and that there would be no money for it. And in fact, law enforcement in Jacksonville began warning the government that they did not have the ability to actually make a convention safe. They couldn't provide security. They didn't have the funding for it. They didn't have the manpower for it. They were completely overwhelmed by what over the course of the month grew into an out of control epidemic. And they could not guarantee the president's safety or anyone else's safety. So it just kept being awesome. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the Secret Service is down manpower because of all the people who got sick in part during the last couple of rallies the president did. Everything's really good is the point I'm making.
Well thought out, too.
You know, yeah. You know what else is good, Cody, Robert, yeah. Katie?
What are you at?
Yeah.
You know what can guarantee your security in the city of Jacksonville, Florida?
Cans.
Coronavirus.
Yeah,
of coronavirus. Cans of coronavirus.
So please buy your own canned coronavirus. Now.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
Oh my God, we're back. We're back. We're back.
Oh, jeez. Oh, wow.
Yes. So.
Good break.
You know, basically what seems to have happened, and again, the New York Times has been kind of the outlet that has most heavily covered the convention drama within the Republican Party. Basically what happened is that internally, all of Trump's advisors, at least the vast majority of Trump's advisors, who most of whom have a certain base level of competence that includes not wanting to die of the plague, repeatedly tried to push him to not do a convention, that doing one even in Jacksonville was a horrible idea. They tried to get him excited about like online town halls and convince him that he could reach tens of thousands of people, you know, in individual towns and regions without making them leave their houses. But publicly, they would have to go and talk about what a good idea it was to hold a convention and how well the convention was going to go, because we're just a fundamentally broken society these days. Now, one of the things that made Trump and his officials kind of hesitant to cancel the convention was the fact that they are continuing to push the reopening of schools. And so there were a lot of like folks who were kind of on the pro-convention side of things who were like, well, if we're going to reopen schools and we cancel the convention, how do we justify that? That's cool. So
how do you justify that?
Well, they kind of seem to have landed on the fact that most of the Trump supporters at the conventions would have been over 50, and so they were in danger. But clearly, teachers are all young, and student and young and little kids never get hurt by diseases.
No.
So schools must be reopened. And I hate to say this because, like, I can't, it's a sign of how weird the year has been that I'm not in favor of spreading the plague to children, but I just don't think it's a good idea in this current economic environment.
Wow, bold pivot.
Mm-hmm. I'm now anti-infecting children with the plague. That's how bad things have gotten. So
whatever you say, man.
Are you pro the plague?
I'm on the fence.
A lot of compelling evidence to suggest that Q would like the children to return to schools,
mm-hmm.
because they are the actual plague. Let's get them all together mm-hmm. and kill them.
You know what renders you immune to being molested by a cabal of Democrats?
Coronavirus.
That's exactly right. A ventilator.
Mm. yep.
I don't. Yeah, it's not great. So, yeah, things continued to degenerate. At one point, the plan was to have they started like coming up with alternate plans for how to do a partly in-person convention, and they were trying to minimize the risk to people, but the plan they came up with just would have risked people in multiple cities. So they had this idea to open the convention with a single night convention in Houston that would be opened by Melania Trump. And then they would have on the second night a single night convention in Indiana that would be opened by Vice President Mike Pence.
So dumb.
And then on the third night, President Trump would make a speech in Jacksonville. So they came up with just do, instead of a three night convention in one state, what if we do 3 1 night conventions?
Yeah, you spread it out like that.
Spread it out all over the country.
You spread it out that way. There's more of it.
Yeah.
I can't even, like... Yeah.
There's an amazing line in the New York Times article about this. Quote, proponents of that plan said a roving convention could have been spun as a powerful message about the country reopening everywhere, with the bonus of avoiding a single large crowded gathering for full days in one city. It's just amazing. It's astonishing.
Sound logic. I don't see
the
problem.
I can't believe how dumb it all is. But yeah, it does seem like, so obviously eventually, like a week or so ago, the president was like, all right, well, we're not gonna do it. Now the Republicans are planning to do basically the same thing as the Democrats, right? President Trump's gonna give a speech.
Cooks.
They're going to have like a minimal sort of thing. They're gonna start, they're gonna have one night in Jacksonville where there's again literally like 100 or 200 people who do kind of the legally necessary voting shit. And then Trump's gonna give a speech in Jacksonville. No press are going to be allowed, almost no people are going to be allowed. There's not going to be crowded rooms of fans or anything. And then it'll be over. And we will continue to barely care about the election as we fist fight police in the streets and prepare to set up sniper traps for the landlords coming to evict us. It's going to be a fun August and September.
What a...
Jesus.
Yeah.
It really is.
That's going to be a real low energy speech.
I don't think it's going to be great.
That's going to be like a toss up between which one is more painful to watch, him or Biden's. Like they're both going to be like, if he can't feed off the energy of a crowd, he's useless.
No. And that's what's great. And I just based on the interview he recently gave to that, was he Australian?
Jonathan Swan from Axios.
My assumption is that his acceptance speech is just going to be a spirited 90-minute defense of Ghislaine Maxwell.
Oh. Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
He's working on it now. He's trying to get like as much
just he pulls out a PowerPoint line by line. He's going through like the charging documents.
Yeah. Here's why I wish her well.
And
okay?
then just keep wishing her well. It's going to be a nightmare.
It's
It'll be
so
a
good.
Fascinating nightmare.
Yeah. So everything, it's just going to keep being bad. But there's not going to be a convention, and that's a bummer. A real bummer. I was looking forward to taking you all. We were starting to talk about inviting my young photojournalist friend Garrison before it became clear that there wouldn't be a convention. I was really looking forward to endangering the life of a teenager as well as the lives of my co-hosts by going to Florida.
Well, a teenager is dancing dangerously close to being a child, so we already established that they all deserve to die from this.
Yeah, that is true, Katie.
Back to
That's
school
true.
Or back so, to the, you know, the convention, one or the other.
Speaking of everything being good, I wanted to talk a little bit about mail-in voting. You know, that sexy topic that's on the front of everybody's minds.
Ooh, yeah.
So do you remember when the president suggested that the election be delayed indefinitely?
Yep.
You remember that?
I do remember that.
But it was days ago. Yeah, no, he did that because of, you know, the pandemic, even though, as we've already mentioned, you know, kids would have to go back to school, but no, we have to delay the election. Anyway, after a lot of pressure from everybody, including Republican leaders, he sort of abandoned that and pivoted to a new demand or suggestion that the election be called on November 3rd, even if millions of ballots remain uncounted.
This seems like something that couldn't possibly spark massive violence nationwide.
No, not possibly.
He wouldn't want that.
That's not from him. I've got this quote. "I've been watching elections, and they say the projected winner or the winner of the election. I don't want to see that take place in a week after November 3rd or a month, or frankly, with litigation and with everything else that can happen, years. But let's be real here. Millions of ballots will be uncounted on November 3rd. There's many reasons for that. But one big one is what is happening with the Postal Service right now. And this is where I talk a little bit about the Postal Service. So what is happening with the Postal Service? It's not good. I'm sure everybody is all aware of Trump's attacks on the postal service, his repeated claims that they can't be trusted to deliver ballots. This has all come at a time when the post office was already under extreme financial distress over the past 10 years. Post offices
on
have
purpose.
Been closed. Mm. Well, they've been closed across the country. Rural mail delivery is stretched thin. Thousands of post office workers' positions have been cut. And this is, of course, has been exacerbated by the pandemic. Thousands of postal workers have taken emergency leave to quarantine after contracting the virus or when they had to care for their children. And these absences have led to a lot of delays in mail delivery, especially in a lot of swing states like Ohio and Michigan. The outgoing Postmaster General recently warned that without immediate intervention, they could run out of funds within the year, meaning that they would have to shut down, which is just something so unfathomable. Of course, Trump's attacks didn't start with the election on the post office. That's just, let's be real, that's the latest tactic he's using to sow doubts in the whole process. No. But he's been railing against the post office for years, primarily because of their relationship with Amazon and Jeff Bezos. They get a discounted shipping contract from the post office. But that's all kind of, you know, general information about what's happening. But now let's talk about Louis DeJoy, who's the Trump donor with no experience, who has become the new Postmaster General. This little excerpt is from the Washington Post. DeJoy, a North Carolina logistics executive who donated more than $2 million to GOP political committees over the past 4 years, approved changes that took effect July 13th that the agency said were aimed at cutting costs for the debt-laden mail service. That's what they said. They included prohibiting overtime pay, shutting down sorting machines early, and requiring letter carriers to leave mail behind when necessary to avoid extra trips or late delivery on routes. The new policies have resulted in at least a two-day delay in scattered parts of the country, even for express mail, according to multiple postal workers and union leaders. Letter carriers are manually sorting more mail, adding to the delivery time. Bins of mail ready for delivery are sitting in post offices because of scheduling and route changes, and without the ability to work overtime, workers say the logjam is worsening without an end in sight." End quote. That's just a
terrifying.
Brief... It is terrifying, and it poses very, very real concerns on how long it will take for people to receive their ballots, if they even will receive their ballots, and then after that, how long it'll take for ballots to be sent back, if they will even be received when they are sent back. Because, you know, what we need in an election is uncertainty about whether or not our ballots are going to get counted. I believe that there are only 16 states that require mail-in ballots to just be postmarked on election day. But there are 34 states that will not accept mail-in ballots after election day. And to make it even more confusing, each state has their own rules and timeframes. For example, Alaska will accept a ballot for up to 10 days post-race if it's postmarked on or before the election day. But in Kansas, voters only have like 3 days or something like that post-election. It's just all incredibly frustrating.
Sounds like we might not have an election.
You know what I love is that Oregon, a state so profoundly dysfunctional that our police officers tear gassed us more than 100 times in the space of 5 weeks for yelling at them from the streets. And we have had the largest budget shortfall of any state in the country over the coronavirus. And we're still attempting to reopen bars and restaurants. Like a historically dysfunctional state that no one lives in, that hates funding their own schools, has been able to, for many years now, run elections completely through the mail, despite the fact that politics here has always been a complete fucking disaster. Oregon
Very
manages to do it, but it's impossible for the rest of the country, clearly. No other state could handle such a task.
What's been so frustrating about this is to see this conversation, us just talking in circles about it for so long. About this issue when
every day.
But honestly, for years now. And the problem is, I spoke about this uncertainty. Okay, this postal service stuff, the way the pandemic has affected the question of how the election will be run, all of that is new. But this issue of mail-in voting is not new. And it's something we've all known. We need to start getting organized with a long time ago in order for people to understand how it works, to have confidence in how it works. And at this point, it's just I don't see how we pull it off. I don't see how this is anything but a debacle, especially with the president demanding that results be announced the night of and all of these delays that we're seeing. We're all aware that Trump has been raging against mail-in voting for a long time now. It terrifies him. The prospect of getting more voters and making it easier for people to vote could potentially be catastrophic for the Republican Party, except not really, because they can stand to benefit from it as well with all their rural voters, with their old white racist voters who are susceptible to viruses. You know, in theory, it could be a boon for the GOP in those regions with those demographics. Just what I was interesting earlier today, Trump tweeted this out. Whether you call it vote by mail or absentee voting, in Florida, the election system is safe and secure, tried and true. Florida's voting system has been cleaned up. We defeated Democrats' attempts at change. So in Florida, I encourage all to request a ballot and vote by mail. Hashtag MAGA. So it benefits him there, clearly.
I mean, that's just fun that he's using the, like, Florida figured it out.
But, you know, all the other states
haven't. He was around for 2000 when Florida didn't really work out, but great job.
That's too long ago. He doesn't remember that. I don't
yeah,
know. It's all just really, it's terrifying.
I mean, no matter what happens, no one is going to be satisfied with the results of the election.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Doubt has been planted in every single person about no matter what the result is.
Yeah. Like, honestly, either President Trump is willing to take power and no one on the left stops him, or the Democratic Party is willing to take back power and no one on the right winds up really having the cojones to stop them. One of those two things will happen, and nobody will believe in the validity of the election. Not even most of the people who get their way in the end.
So you right? don't think that nope. this is going to be a big uniting event?
No,
for the country.
I think this is the. I think we're at the start of a death spiral that's more or less unstoppable at this point.
Honey, we've been spiraling for a while now.
Yeah.
We're just picking up speed.
We've been sick for a while, like a coral reef. But there's a certain point in like the death of a coral reef where the reef itself is still alive, but the damage is so extensive that its annihilation is inevitable. And I think that's the point that we're at.
Great. I also want to point out that you know Katie is serious when she throws out, honey.
One other thing I'm serious about before we take an ad break is, I guess, the takeaway, the call to action I want to impart with you guys about this conversation, and that's to send your ballots in immediately. Do not sit on it. Send it in, especially if you live in a state that is not honoring ballots that come in after Election Day. So please check up your state's rules and please be responsible about it and tell all your friends. If there's one thing I would love to see from our listeners, it is their own work at getting this issue out. Send in your ballots immediately. And
yeah, I was just joking about the country being doomed, by the way. Everything's going to be okay. Please
send
vote.
Please vote.
Right,
It'll be fine.
And please enjoy these ads we're bringing to you right now. And please stick around for after the ads when we're back to talk more about this nightmare.
Welcome to the worst year ever. We'll get through it together or not. Everything is so dumb, 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 dumb.
We're back. I was just thinking about how I really have deep and profound faith in democracy and the fundamental courage and decency of the American people, and things are going to be great. That's what I was thinking about.
I don't believe you.
I think that adds up.
Because I'm a liar.
As Katie would say, honey.
Oh, honey. Yeah.
So, let's keep going.
I mean,
Cody,
what do you got for us? It's so like...
He's clutching his face in horror. Cody was given the task of Trump's latest bullshit and his inherent authoritarianism.
Yeah, the authoritarian stuff. And this is going to be a chaotic little hodgepodge of just frustration, because the thing is, I mean, both of you had shades of this in your in what we're talking about. It's impossible to not touch on it every day. And I think what we're really pointing to when we talk about this now is obviously the, the secret police and the election pushing and stuff. One thing I will say is that I think a lot of people are starting to use the word fascist more to refer to the president specifically. A little bit, you'd see it sprinkled in. Not really a lot of political figures using the word. Not really a lot of actual journalists in the mainstream media using that word. They've been very afraid to use the word. But you can find an article from 2 days ago that is just called Trump's tactics are right out of the authoritarian playbook. And you can find an article from 3.5 years ago called Trump's tactics are right out of the authoritarian playbook. And it's starting to just feel oppressively useless. Every step of the way, where we are. And again, 4 years ago, people talking about we're a boiling frog, they push the line a little bit. And every little bit you get used to, and then we're here or whatever. And I just get this overwhelming sense of that, especially now, mm-hmm. in looking and how people talk about him, because it really hasn't changed much. It's gotten a bit louder. But whenever even his election quote and his tweets about pushing that election back, the reaction would be, this is extremely dangerous, or he didn't really mean it. It's just something he says. He's not really going to do anything, or like he actually can't do that, which is, one could say, a bit naive.
One could say that.
One could maybe say that. Because even like since the beginning, tweeting things like, I have the support of the police, the support of the military, the support of the bikers for Trump. I have the tough people, but they don't play it tough until they go to a certain point, and then it would be very bad, very bad. And like people kind of freaked out, but then also people were like, well, he's not like, what's he's is this a tweet? But then you have him sending in the feds to beat the shit out of Robert and like and all these protesters.
Oh, no,
in the
we're
streets.
Fun. We're friends. We get along.
You're having, you know, you're having a great time.
We got a thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
I tweeted this today. You're reminding me of it because it was just today. I just was thinking back on everybody in 2016, the day after the election, saying, how bad can it be? He can't do that much. Calm down. How bad can it be, they said. Anyway, sorry, continue.
Well, I mean, yeah, so like that's how bad can it be? And it can be a global pandemic and sending in the feds to cities to clean up the crime because he's the law and order president, right? And it's just sort of like he's cashing all these checks, right, that we all saw him write since the beginning. He does all the things that authoritarians talk about, at least. He's always talked about all the leaders who have... You know, well, now he's president for life. Maybe we should do that. Like all these sort of like little praisings of authoritarians now and throughout history.
Mm-hmm.
And his approach to everything is in conflict with reality. And that has always been something that has been like a touchstone of like fascist movements. Literally, Mussolini said that, to create a fascist national myth, it is not necessary for it to be a reality. It's all based on this fake spiritual myth making, and getting people like working people up into a frenzy, saying these sort of like trial balloon phrases and like talking about the violence. I got the tough people. He's not going to do anything. He talks about those things, and then he doesn't necessarily. It's not about crossing the line, right? It's about nudging the line a little farther.
Yeah, you keep and moving so the goalpost.
You move it a little bit, and then, so now the resistance is a little bit closer to where the line used to be. They've crossed the old line, but you don't see them crossing the line because the line is actually moved. And it's just been this sort of slow slog of him doing all these things and saying all these things, and, I don't know. We're in the middle of this crisis, and one thing I think that can be said about also like fascist movements and regimes in general, aside from the fact that they don't like start at the end, which I see a lot of people say, like, well, you can call him a fascist, therefore he's not. Well, okay, that's not how time works. So he's done, like, you do all these things, but one thing you can say is that if there's a major crisis, it's either really good or really bad for them, right?
Mm-hmm.
This, in our leaders' like gross incompetence and very obvious ignorance, even in the Axios interview that Robert mentioned earlier, we see this sort of floundering and struggle because they can't actually deal with a crisis. They can manufacture them, they can take advantage of them, but they can't actually deal with them. And so we're sort of in this spot where this, like, what is happening now could be them crumbling, because that's how they have to deal with things. Or it could mean that they're going to keep sending in, you know, the law and order folks, because they've conditioned so many people to see any single protester as, like, you're the Antifa. You're, like, even you have columnists who are, like, quote, liberals who are, like, demonizing Antifa and being like, we shouldn't defend Antifa just to, like, fight the fascists. Like, well, what are you doing? Like, well, you're helping them. You're helping this narrative.
Right.
I'm going to read this, just a brief passage from Robert Pax's book about this kind of thing. Fascist violence was neither random nor indiscriminate. It carried a well-calculated set of coded messages that communist violence was rising, that the democratic state was responding to it ineptly, and that only the fascists were tough enough to save the nation from anti-national terrorists. An essential step in the fascist march to acceptance and power was to persuade law and order conservatives and members of the middle class to tolerate fascist violence as a harsh necessity in the face of left provocation. It helped, of course, that many ordinary citizens never feared fascist violence against themselves because they were reassured that it was reserved for national enemies and terrorists who deserved it.
So, to bring it back to the election a little bit, I mean, we see that rhetoric, of course, already in play in his tweets and everything, but in the campaign videos. The campaign videos that I've seen from Donald Trump are Joe Biden wants no more police. It's not anything.
Joe Biden is a secret Antifa, right?
And yeah, you know, and
yeah, he's been showing up in block here in Portland. He chucked a chucked a Molotov at a Fed the other night.
Changes my view of him entirely.
But then also you get him making statements about Portland, and he's referring to how we need to lock up the aggravators and the anarchists. And that is just like straight up. Just like it's just this again. It's the same old playbook. It's Joe Biden saying it instead. You can't like assign like it's a political ideology. He's saying we should lock up the anarchists. That's like saying we'll lock up all the libertarians or we'll lock up all the like whatever it is. And that is a bonkers thing to say. Sorry, Katie. Go ahead.
No. Yeah. I mean, it just seems like that is the main thing that he is going to be hammering for the next few months.
And it's easy for other people to get like swept up into it, right?
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
Joe Biden didn't need to say we need to lock up all the anarchists or prosecute the anarchists. But it's this sort of tactic of framing everything like this where even the opposition will play into it.
And it's all this confusion. I mean, it even stems back to when this protest movement began, you know, people conflating and also not giving due justice to what a rioter is, you know, like, well, let's break down that term. Let's see what this is. But that's too much for so many people. And there's just, you know, they can see images of violence and fear. And then there's people that might be on the fence but really don't like the way this is playing out, are afraid of the chaos.
And you got to bring order to the chaos. You know who can do it. You know who can bring order to the chaos.
The law and order guy.
The current president who is residing over all the chaos.
The one who wishes the, pimp well. I mean, not to bring up QAnon.
I mean,
but
yeah.
Here I go. I've just seen everything is just chaos. There is information abounding from all sides. People are afraid in a myriad of different ways.
Here's the reality of the situation, unfortunately, which is that everything's always been chaos for most of the people on this planet. Everything was chaos for the people in Bhopal, India, you know, who got 14,000 or so of whom were choked to death almost immediately when that chemical plant went up. Everything was chaos for the Maya people in Guatemala, 200,000 plus of whom were murdered and tens of thousands more of whom were tortured by the right-wing death squads trained by a mix of CIA and border patrol agents. Everything was chaos, has been chaos for, you know, the kids in Yemen, the kids in Pakistan who went and testified in front of our Congress that they're now terrified at the sight of blue skies because it means that drones can come for them and their families. We've had in this country a wall protecting us from the chaos built of money, money and guns. And that wall has crumbled in on itself. And now we just have a pile of guns and rotting dollar bills. And we're no longer can trick ourselves into believing that we're safe.
Yeah.
And that's the what's
that
happening.
Bubble going. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, the people that have power are manipulating that and using that to their advantage.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It's just
it's cool. It's very cool. We're all fans of it, folks.
I just bring that up to say, like, even people, and I've mentioned this on Even More News, I think last week, but people that I wouldn't necessarily consider progressive, but not a fan of the president, I've seen sharing QAnon adjacent, you know, conspiracy theories, yeah, saying you can't trust any media, neither side. And that is a demoralizing state for us to be in a few months away from the election. But I will say my dear friend told me the other day that she had a dream that Biden won. So that's one less thing I have to worry about. So I share that with you guys.
Oh, yeah. Great.
In case it brings you any comfort. My friend dreamt that Biden won, so we don't need to worry about it.
That's excellent. That means
I love her. I'm not making fun of her. She said it tongue in cheek. I think she believed it, but
I mean, that's like, it's just the even the QAnon stuff you're bringing up and like all this adjacent stuff. That's part. I mean, that's obviously part of it, and there's a reckoning there that we have not experienced yet. That I don't even want to open up the QAnon worms right now, really. But like,
no, I don't either.
But the current situation now, aside from all the chaos and all the sort of the veil dropping of what people sort of saw as like, no, we're safe, we're America, it's fine. Aside from all that, this pandemic, it's forcing people to stay inside and not really interact with people on as much of a human level as they used to. And a lot of that means that they're going to be online more. And when you're online more, your brain rots and it's bad for you. And you believe things you shouldn't. And it gets worse and worse. And then you're going to start sharing QAnon memes because you get you get sucked down into that little rabbit hole. And you're like, oh, no, now I'm buried alive in the rabbit hole. And pandemic situation has really exacerbated, I think, a lot of the QAnon stuff specifically, because it is congregated everybody in one just like maddening space. Where everything is just like, you got to grab onto something. You got to, I don't know.
It feels like
it's not good.
It's exponentially exploding right now.
Yeah.
Woo.
You know what I love?
Ending podcasts?
No, I don't love ending podcasts. I love
Cherry Dr. Pepper.
I do. I do love Cherry Dr. Pepper. You know what I love? I love right now watching the videos coming in from Beirut. The day we film this is the day of a horrific explosion that seems to have been the result of an improperly stored, confiscated ammonium nitrate fireworks and somebody it's probably the largest non-nuclear explosion maybe in world history. Just unbelievable devastation. The videos coming out of Beirut like now look like the end of the damn world.
It's horrific.
And looking at it and knowing, number one, that this is not even the beginning, because Beirut has been dealing with an economic collapse, food shortages, the fact that this port was like a major port for a lot of the grain that fed a significant chunk of the Middle East. So the food shortages are going to get even worse, not just in Lebanon, but all over the rest of the region as a result of this. A lot of the damage, because the economic collapse, is never going to be repaired. So huge chunks of the city, people are going to be going without windows and without, power, even more than they already have been. A lot of folks I talked to in Beirut were already dealing with 22 hours a day without electricity before this. Just a complete nightmarish collapse. And it's terrible. And it also, it's like a trailer for what's going to be happening all over more often as the systems around the world, the security systems that individual nations put in place, and kind of international trade systems and sort of the basic protections people tried to set in place, continue to fray in the face of global chaos. I'm reminded in what happened in Lebanon, an explosion back in, I think, 2013 in the town of West Texas, which I was there the very next day. That was that massive ammonium nitrate explosion in that little Texas town that like almost wiped it off the face of the damn map.
Yeah.
And it's always at the end of the day. Like right now, there's conspiracy theory spreading like Israel has bombed Lebanon, and it's not. Like the fundamentally kind of the thing that we're probably going to find out with Beirut is more or less what we found out with West and the explosion there, which is that a mix of improper storage, a complete like gutting of any sort of regulation or attempts at like actually providing a security and protection for things like this by the government in order to like cut costs, like all of these things that happen as a state starts to fail are what resulted in this calamity and what will result in future calamities. And there will be explosions like this in other places, and the suffering will continue to spread. Because at the end of the day, we made a decision as a society to suck all of the money out globally from anything that wasn't creating more money. And it's good.
I mean, in so many different capacity, things are going to continue to be destabilized.
Yeah.
And this is an effect. Like, again, going back to how bad could he be, you know, when he was elected in 2016, I remember, and I've mentioned this before on shows, having a conversation with an old friend who was a Trump supporter, and him being like, yeah, because he works in construction, wanting deregulation, saying, you know, all this stuff, wanting, and I understand that zoning laws can be tricky and dumb on a municipal level, you know, like locally, but regulations in general are there for a reason, as you were just mentioning with Beirut.
It's in regulations and watchdog groups that attempt to, like, a lot of the reason why shit has gotten to be such a problem in Beirut is that you have all these, like, this is like people in Beirut have been protesting and, like, livid over corruption in their local and national government for a long time, and, like, other calamities have been occurring for a while as a result of this corruption and incompetence. There were massive wildfires not all that long ago that were horribly exacerbated by the fact that, like, money that was supposed to go towards allowing the state to fight these wildfires and train people was lining the pockets of corrupt officials. We're just seeing this cycle accelerate all over the world, basically everywhere. And whenever people try to stop it, and you have things like the Panama Papers, right, where, like, some brave crusading journalist will reveal a chunk of the massive worldwide graft network that keeps making everything worse, they kill them with a firebomb in their car, and everybody moves on. And conservatives convince everyone that it's much more reasonable to be angry at the fact that a single kid on a college campus lit Steven Crowder's book on fire. Some stupid shit like that. Whatever. Like, dumb bullshit. Mm. It's all terrible, and I hate it.
It's bad. Stupid. It's unhelpful, everything. The president, speaking of everything we just talked about, just shared that fun little gif where it says Trump 2020, then Trump 2024, then Trump 2028, then Trump 2032. And it's jokes about how he's going to be the president forever, because that's what good presidents do. They try
very
to, like,
fun.
My favorite thing about presidents is when they viscerally hate more than half the country and try to make that half the country mad every second of the day.
But he's a nice guy.
He is a nice guy. He wishes that child predator well.
The child, yep.
Brought it all
back
around.
And that's what we really need to think about, you know, at the end of the day, not the people of Lebanon, not all of the people suffering in our own country, not the folks staring houselessness in the face, not the hundreds of thousands of refugees around the world still in camps from conflicts from Syria to Malaysia. What we really need to think about and dedicate our sympathy towards is that child rapist.
Mm-hmm.
God bless her. Thank you, Gillian Maxwell, for your sacrifices.
Oh, I remember you in a past episode saying that you refused to learn how to pronounce her name.
Yeah, I was about to say
but
that.
Katie, like every figure anyone ever trusted, I was always a liar.
Yeah, stay in your jizz lane.
Cody.
Oh,
sorry.
Like,
I'm sorry.
Oh, that one hurt. That one really did some damage to me.
A good place for us to wrap this up.
We're all doing our best, okay?
Stay in your goddamn giz lane, y'all.
Oh, my God.
Yep.
I will never not pronounce it giz lane. I'm sorry.
Look, if you want to make the world better, find a child predator near you and express solidarity with them.
wish them well.
Now. Yeah, wish
them well. And then when you're asked about a civil rights hero 10 minutes later, be like, I don't know the guy. What are you talking about? And then move on.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Dan,
please edit this in the funniest way possible.
No, Dan, leave it all in.
And then just cut to me saying this.
Keep it all in.
Yeah.
This is the end of the episode. You can follow Katie on Twitter and Instagram at Katie Stoll. You can follow Cody on Twitter and Instagram at Dr. Mr. Cody. You can follow Robert on Twitter at I Write Okay. You can follow this podcast on Twitter and Instagram at Worst Year Pod. We have a merch store. That's it.
It's got stuff in it.
That's all the things, and you should wash your hands, wear a face mask, and have a blessed day.
Everything's so dumb. Everything's so dumb, and it's gonna get dumber.
Great.
I tried.
Yes.
Daniel?
Lovely.
Worst Year Ever is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.